Campus FM presents 100 Years of Women on Campus, produced and presented by Patricia Camilleri. Welcome to this anniversary series, remembering 100 years of women on campus. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and I shall be looking at this theme from many different angles, the sociological, the statistical, the anthropological, and the historical. I shall be asking questions about life for female students and academics on and off campus, yesterday and today, and possibly also tomorrow. I'm very pleased to have with me today on the program Dr. Anna Borge, who is here to tell us about the gender pay gap. Welcome to you, Dr. Borge.
Thank you very much, Patricia.
As usual, I just want to say a few brief words about you because I know our listeners like to know a little bit about the academics here on campus. Some people might know you, but others might not. Dr. Borge has a diploma in social studies from this university. She gained her master's in science from the Manchester Metropolitan University and read for her PhD with the University of Middlesex. She's a lecturer here at the University of Malta now and director of the University Centre for Labour Studies, to which I'm glad to say we shall be dedicating another whole programme. So we can go straight into the discussion about gender pay gap. I'm sure a lot of listeners have heard about it, and in a way one can understand from the title more or less what it's about, but I'm sure there's a lot that you can tell us. Let's start off with a definition of gender pay gap.
Okay, first of all, the gender pay gap usually raises a lot of controversies. There are some people who would tell you, you know, this is a myth, I mean, and they would dismiss it. They say it's rubbish, you know, like we have the laws in place, so everybody's being paid the same. And of course, then there are academics who look into the subject and backed with data from National Statistics Office from around the world, and especially with us being in the EU, we tend to compare what is happening in Malta with the EU. And using that data, a lot of other people would argue that it is very much a reality in 2019 when we assume that we have, you know, kind of arrived and we are pretty equal in terms of women and men's earnings. In reality, you know, this data and science tell us a different story. So the wage gap is very much alive. In Malta, it has been increasing in the last years. For, you know, like about a decade ago, we had one of the lowest, but now we are inching very closely to the EU level. So the gender pay gap at EU level is around 16%. And the data I have for 2017, the wage gap in Malta stood at 12.2%. So we are, you know, every year this is increasing, and the gap earnings is unfortunately also increasing.
Actually widening.
It's widening, yeah.
A bit frightening.
Yeah.
Before we go into the reasons for that,
yeah.
You mentioned the EU. Mm-hmm. We have, I suppose, certain obligations with the EU
exactly.
With regard to gathering of statistics.
Yeah.
So this isn't just something that we want to do, something that we have to do.
Exactly.
I imagine.
Yeah, this is a study which is done every 4 years across the whole of the EU. So there is a formula which is applied across the EU. The data is usually collected by the National Statistics Office. Through the source of the data is the Structure of Earnings Survey. So it's an actual survey. And the last full data we had was in 2014. And the survey was done again last year. So we are now, because this is a massive exercise, waiting for the results of the latest survey, which happened last year across the EU. So we'll have to see where we're going and what changes there are, both across the EU and especially in Malta, because that's where our interest is.
Our interest lies. Yes. With regards to gathering that data, mm-hmm. I would imagine that it must be a huge job. If we're talking about an equation, it must be a very long one.
Well, it's not a very long equation. It's actually, they pool all the earnings of all men across all the different sectors, across all the different jobs. And then they look at the same earnings that women are earning, and they look at the difference between the average gross hourly earnings of men and women, expressed as a percentage of the average gross hourly earnings of men. So that is the formula. It sounds simple, but I can assure you it is a complicated exercise. So that's why it takes so long, and it's done every 4 years. But basically, you are pooling in all the wages of men, all the wages of women, and then looking at the difference and putting it out as an hourly rate, you know, so that you can compare like with like. It's the hourly rate, and depending on how much you work, that also differs.
I think there must be, I mean, I'm trying to imagine this gender pay gap in different sectors, because there are so many possibilities, so many sectors, so many different areas of work, areas where there's a preponderance of men, areas where there's a preponderance of women. How do they calculate that you are doing the same work as me? That kind of thing sort of blows my mind a bit.
Yes, it is complicated, and you are not comparing exactly like with like. It's the average hourly rate when you look at everybody's wages together. So it's an average rather than. So then last year, fortunately, we had a study done by NSO, and it did look into these details, and perhaps later on in the program we can start giving out a few of these findings, very interesting findings, which look at, you know, what's happening in particular sectors, or what is happening with people of different levels of education, or whether, you know, being a mother makes a difference. So fortunately, last year, for the first time, we had this very interesting study, and it can give us a few of these answers of a very complicated issue. So you cannot, it's not a simplistic study, and it's a complex issue. So
let's start off with sector then.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the study did actually find that it makes a difference where you work. So there were specific sectors where the wage gap was above average and others where it was below. But for example, if you look at the financial and insurance activities sector, where possibly we would be getting graduates working there, you know, like in order to be able to work in the financial and in the insurance, you would get probably people with at least A levels and then people who have a first degree. And there the wage gap goes up to 28%, 28.3, as against an average of 12%. So in that particular sector, where it is attracting quite a lot of women, the wage gap is massive. Similarly, if you look at professional, scientific and technical activities, again, the wage gap is above average and it's about 23.1%. So again, another big gap. And in information and communication, it's 20%. The arts and entertainment and the recreation activities, it's 19%. Wholesale and retail, where the level of education is going down, it's 18%, always above average, and another 18.8% in manufacturing. So in these sectors, these are the economic activities with the highest gender pay gap rates.
That's a little bit counterintuitive, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, it was quite revealing, you know, it was not something we knew or we were expecting, but yes.
Because you would imagine that if we're talking education, that women who have an education would be more aware of the possibility of a discrepancy between mm-hmm. what their male counterparts are getting yeah. and what they're getting.
Well, that's a wrong assumption.
Absolutely. I can see that now.
For two things. First of all, in a lot of private sector organization, there is a culture of secrecy around wages. So in some sectors and in some organizations, they actually make workers sign a declaration that they will not discuss their wages. So very often when you ask people and you check their awareness about the wage gap, the majority of people on the first instance, they will tell you, of course not, you know, it can't be happening. They assume it's not happening, but they don't know. They don't have access to other people's income. So they're very much making their assumptions. Yes, assumptions. So that's the first thing. And also, your education, unfortunately, does not protect you from the wage gap. The NSO study actually found that the higher your level of education, the higher the wage gap, which was quite astounding, you know. Having a tertiary education meant a wage gap of around nearly 19%. People with a secondary or post-secondary had a wage gap of 12%, which is within the national average, and those with a basic level of education had a lower wage gap. So unfortunately, no, your education does not protect you from getting less money for perhaps doing the same job. Mm. You know, so
it's a very interesting finding.
Very interesting finding, which I think is a little bit shocking, because once you look at people and what level of education, their training, and so on, you would expect that they would be very similar. But this is not what data is showing us, unfortunately.
I worked 25 years in here at the university, so I suppose it's sort of, I just looked at the level and mm-hmm. didn't cross my mind to question whether, at the end of the day, I was director of an administrative department. It didn't cross my mind, because I would imagine that within institutions such as this one, mm-hmm. or government institutions, there would be checks and balances with regards to contractual agreements, collective agreements, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing.
What we know is where there is a collective agreement, actually the wage gap is lower. But that doesn't mean that in the public sector there is no wage gap. There is actually a wage gap there too. It happens because a part of the wage gap is determined by looking at the number of people at the top. And people at the top usually are men, and their earnings are much, much higher. And if we look at university, I suppose if we did a study, we would find a wage gap, and part of it would be contributed through the difference in top level men and women occupying those very top posts with very high earnings. And as we know, those are largely, you know, professorships and so on. There are more males than females occupying those posts, and that contributes to the wage gap in some way. So it doesn't mean you're safe, you know. And then in private organization, the wage gap also looks into perks and bonuses, and very often those are, you know, very much up to the employer to decide. Perhaps they are things which are not strictly related to the original wage agreed, you know. And we know that men do get more perks and more bonuses, and that as well contributes to the wage gap. And very often people wouldn't know what the other person is getting.
So what they're getting in real terms.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about the male trajectory in a career and the female trajectory in a career, which is valid for people with a lower income and also people in a middle or a higher income? Mm-hmm. How does that sort of, does it skew the picture? How does it work out?
The fact that men have a more linear and regular work trajectory without gaps, you know, for linked to maternity and so on, does contribute to the wage gap, because we know that your wage increases with the number of years you remain working with the same organization. It depends whether you work full-time or part-time. It depends whether you take paternity or parental leave, and we know that very few men take paternity leave. And so in the eyes of the employers, it's always the man who is the norm, kind of. So if we're going to invest in training and education, if we are going to promote somebody, we tend to promote men, because we operate in gendered organizations. And because women take time out to care, because they take time out to, when the children are young, perhaps to work reduced hours or to work part-time to be able to pick them up from school, etc. In the eyes of employers, women are what Acker calls deviants, you know. So so because of that, because women care and men don't, mothers pay a very high price for that, and it's actually called the motherhood penalty. It is a phenomenon which is, it's studied, and there is actually evidence, even in the wage gap, that mothers who have children actually suffer a higher wage gap than fathers who have children. So fathers are not penalized for having children, but women are, because of these kind of norm and deviant outlook at looking at people who care and people who do not give their time to care.
Even the semantics of that,
I know,
is indicative of the issue, really.
It is. And the problem is not because women care, because I am sure most of the employers want to have future clients. They want to have future workers. So they want us to have children. It's in their interest. So the problem is not women having children and caring, but because we still live in an age and time where men are allowed not to care, where they are not made to, for example, take their paternity leave in equal weeks or months as the mother does, so that we can kind of break that idea of the ideal worker being a male who does not procreate, who does not care. And in order to challenge the notion of the ideal male worker, we need to find ways how to get men to care more. Now, how are we going to do that is a very tricky question. It needs a lot of thought. But the solution definitely lies not in having women care less, but in making men responsible for their caring part and sharing it more equally, especially now where we're seeing 60% of our graduates being female. I am sure that those women want a career and they want to have children. But at the same time, we have men who are graduating who think they can have the family they want without doing any sacrifices to their career and without giving some of the time and sharing it equally with their partner. And that is where the solution lies. How do we make men to care more? How do we bring the issue of fairness into this? Because it is an issue of fairness which we have not looked into enough, which we haven't named and shamed enough in a way. And men can just get on with life. They usually have a nice family, they have a career they want, and they don't pay the same price as mothers do. And mothers do pay a price. And that is resulting in the feminization of poverty, because then if they separate, and separations are increasing, because mothers have these gaps, because mothers care, because they don't go up, you know, they're not giving the same promotions, when they separate, and usually they are left with the children to take care of, you know.
It exacerbates the situation.
It does. Mm. And that affects also their pension later on. So overall, it's a contributing factor to poverty.
There are certain private institutions, I'm thinking of certain accounting firms, that know very well the large majority of their employees are going to be women, and have actually try to create genuine family-friendly mm-hmm. measures which will encourage women to actually join the workforce if they feel that they're appreciated enough that they're bothering to provide, childcare mm-hmm. In the basement or something like
okay.
that. I think in other professions, perhaps it's more difficult, however much a guy would like to help out at home, you know, if he's looking for promotion and this sort of thing, if there isn't a family-friendly attitude at the top, well, you know, your promotion is going to depend on how many hours you're going to be
exactly.
working.
Exactly. We still judge then, being the ideal worker by the number of hours, not by output, for
exactly.
example.
There's no way they're going to actually, even if they want to,
yeah.
be able to contribute.
And also having, you know, work-life measures in place only for mothers, I find that rather disturbing, because when you're doing that, you're still kind of promoting the mommy track, you know, you're still saying caring is linked to mothers. So I think that is another challenge. How do you make family-friendly measures and the uptake? It's, you know, one thing having the measures there, and it's another thing, you need to look at the uptake. Who is taking the leave? Who is working flexibly? Who is reducing their hours? So you need to make sure that they're open to everyone, absolutely everyone, not just mothers who have children. I mean, in today's lives, everybody has, you know, is trying to cope with so many things. You may have elderly parents and you may be male. You may be studying, so you need flexibility. You may be doing sports or going to the gym, so you need flexibility. So I think we also need to shatter this idea that flexi work and finding new ways of working is only available for mothers. I think that's a little bit tragic, and it will just perpetuate the old idea that mothers and caring are deviants, and we have to find them a solution, but let the men work the traditional way, kind of. So that's a,
our work practices are not catching up with technology, for example. We're still, I look around, I see that in very often there are Victorian kind of models which are still being used in 2019.
Definitely, yes, most definitely. We are still kind of adopting old work practices before the Industrial Revolution, but perhaps, or just after the Industrial Revolution, I would say, when it was assumed that you have a male worker and the woman was at home, kind of, or when that was possible, and not in today's age, where everybody needs to work, where it's very difficult to live by on just one wage, and, you know, where women are becoming better educated and they really want to contribute to society. So unfortunately, no, we have to look at those work practices, and as you rightly said, those who lead them, what are the values, you know, how do they look, do they encourage people to take up, how do they work themselves? Because if you at the top work very long hours, automatically you're giving the message that this is how you should be if you want to make it to the top. So that's why the issue is so complex, and it depends on a lot of variables and a lot of...
Talking about checks and balances before, do you find that, do you think that discrimination, subtle discrimination, still continues when it comes, say, I don't know, to interviews or job opportunities?
It does. It does. It definitely does. I mean, part of the contributor to the wage gap is definitely direct discrimination. So the idea that women are lesser kind of in some way to men, and also linked to the idea that men are breadwinners, so they need to earn more, kind of. There is also that old idea. And one of the things that I show my students when I'm teaching them about the wage gap is a very short video by Oprah Winfrey. Oprah Winfrey, as everybody knows, is a, you know, she's a very talented American actress. She's in the media. She has her own programs. And she speaks about how in the 1980s, she realized she was anchoring with a man doing exactly the same job. You know, this program where she was initially kind of being known as the person she is now. And she was being paid $22,000 and her male anchor was being paid $50,000. So I always tell them, if it happens to Oprah, you know, Oprah's so assertive, it could definitely be happening to you, you know. And when Oprah asked, why is this happening? Her boss told her, why do you need that money? You know, why do you need the same amount? And she said, well, because we're doing exactly the same job. And he told her, I don't think so. And he told her, do you have a house? And she said, no. Do you have children? And she said, no. So he told her, then, you know, you don't need the same amount. And of course, that is what then got her to establish her own company and to decide herself what she would be paid and what the woman working for her would be paid. And now she's worth, you know, $2.9 billion. So thank goodness that she realized that she was being cheated. And, you know, so that is a very clear case of direct discrimination. So it's happening. And you might tell me, well, this happened in the 80s, but I can, for example, tell you other examples. Last year in 2018, in the BBC, where, you know, we look up to the BBC and we think it's a very serious organization, a top BBC journalist, she was the anchor in China, she resigned after she learned that her male peers were paid 50% more, 50% more. This is last year in the UK, in such a prestigious organization. And she resigned as soon as she learned that, but, you know, as soon as she became aware. So this is still happening. So this is blatant, clear-cut discrimination. So that is definitely happening.
Nowadays in interviews, you can't ask a woman Do you intend to have any children in the next few years? I mean, nobody asks that question anymore.
You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised.
I would be shocked.
You would be shocked that my students tell me that they still go for interviews and they are somehow, you know, they would tell them what are your plans for the future, you know, without telling them are you getting married, but they would still find a way to. And in the eyes of employers, you know, they would still think that a man is a safer bet than a, because they don't bear children. So it's still happening, perhaps not directly, but indirectly, I would tell you, yes, it's still happening. And if, even if they don't verbalize it, they're thinking that way by looking, just by looking at women and men, you know, they're thinking, they're making different assumptions about their futures because women bear children. So even if they don't verbalize it, it's still there.
Are there any issues particular to Malta? Is there any particular issue here culturally that makes us any different to any other European country, or do you think the problems more or less are across the board?
The problems are very similar, but I would say the motherhood mandate in Malta is still very strong, and unfortunately our laws are still very traditional in that. Let me give you an example. When parents, they're giving paternity and maternity leave. In the private sector, men get 1 day paternity leave. 1 day. And women get 18 weeks maternity leave. So that in itself, the gross difference, the way that the legislator looks at, you know, the rights of parents, and I'm just saying, you know, a man, 1 day is fine, you go back to work. That in itself gives a very, message. Yeah, it's a very strong and direct message that woman's main role is caring and men's main role is breadwinning and paid work, unfortunately.
Well, we've already come to the end of the program.
Oh,
very quickly. I'm sure we haven't discussed all the issues that we would have liked, or you would have liked to have spoken about, but I'd like to thank Dr. Anna Borge for coming in today to talk to us about the gender pay gap.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to 100 Years of Women on Campus. If you would like to hear the programs again, just go to www.maltauniversitybroadcasting.com and click on webcasts. Join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye. You have just listened to 100 Years of Women on Campus, produced and presented by Patricia Camilleri.